All right, our last case this morning is 2019-621 in re MH for the appellant, Mr. Kuzmans.
Thank you, Your Honor. Good morning, Your Honors, Chief Justice O'Connor. My name is Paul Kuzma on behalf of the child in this case, MH, and I would like to reserve 4 minutes for rebuttal. In this case, we have a compelling situation where a 13-year-old child is separated from his mother, taken, driven to an unfamiliar building with unfamiliar surroundings by his mother, then separated, told that there was a conversation that was going to be private. And that conversation took place in a room with closed doors. The 13-year-old child wasn't told the nature or the purpose of the questioning and the interrogation, and he was never informed of his any constitutional rights or any rights or the right that he had to walk away and not answer questions. And based on this, this court is presented with the question of whether or not statements made under this situation by this child were a product of, were not coerced, were not suggested, and were not a product of his ignorance of his rights. And that's not my language. Those aren't my words. This is the United States Supreme Court in In re Gault. They say in discussing constitutional rights for juveniles and statements made by juveniles without the assistance of counsel, they say that we need to be take great care to ensure that statements and admissions were not the product of coercion, suggestion, and not the product of ignorance of rights or adolescent fantasy, fright, or despair. Yet that is exactly what we have in this case. Now, a lot of the facts that we're going to be discussing today overlap between these two different areas that we have. We have our Fifth Amendment issues and whether or not Miranda should have been given. And we have, but first we have our due process component and whether or not these statements were made of MH as the child's own free will. And I want to say that these facts oftentimes will overlap, and it's especially when it comes to looking at custody analysis for Miranda and whether or not the child felt free to walk away or terminate the encounter that he had here with this social worker that his mom had prearranged with him. But looking first to the tradition.
Counsel, isn't a preliminary issue whether or not Ms. Bradley was a agent of law enforcement?
Only as it relates to the Fifth Amendment, only as it relates to the Miranda issue is whether or not she's a state actor, by all accounts, and it would be a prerequisite under Jackson for the Miranda analysis. And I think that under that analysis, she clearly is, in fact, operating as an agent of law enforcement. But what I want to say first about Jackson is I don't think Jackson paints the exclusive test for determining when a state actor is a law enforcement or acting on a request of law enforcement. It provides part of the test, and it was adapted from Bolden, which was a case involving a private citizen acting as store security. And in that case, the language relied on in Bolden and now in Jackson was this idea of controlling the investigation, having some sort of control over the investigation. And I think that what makes that, but that's an incomplete test. Bolin recognized that. In Bolin, now first a couple things about Bolin. It came down in 1971 and it predates a lot of the other cases that this court has interpreted Miranda in. And it also predates a lot of the cases that are relevant under Ohio or US Supreme Court precedent. But even in Bolin, they recognize that employees of government agencies who with the function of enforcing the law are one person who needs to require Miranda, are a group of people that need to give Miranda warnings, in addition to those acting at the direction and control of law enforcement.
Well, counsel, yes. The social worker was mandated to give her report to the police. Is that a true statement?
Yes, but I think it's only part of the truth. She's also mandated to investigate cooperatively. And I think that there's a difference. That's an additional obligation that is presented. The statute in this case requires not only kind of mandatory reporting, but it also requires mandatory investigation. And a mandatory investigation is done in connection, in cooperation with law enforcement. And now, returning to the Bolin.
Let me just stop you for a minute. Yes. My understanding is that she turned her report over to the detective, and they did not question your client, MH. The detective did not. Is that correct?
That's correct, Your Honor. In fact, the detective didn't do any investigation in this case, in the formal sense of how we would normally think of an investigation. It was Bradley, the Children and Family Services investigator, who, number one, instructed that the alleged victim's mother file a police report, and then interviewed that child's mother.
Counselor, if the detective had done some investigation after getting Bradley's report, would you still be arguing the same error?
Yes, I don't think that simply because the detective does some additional investigation that it insulates the social worker from having to give Miranda warnings under these circumstances. The social worker here did all of the investigation, though, and I think that's extremely important and one of the big differentiations between this case and Jackson as well. But I do want to reinforce this idea that Jackson is an incomplete test of sorts, because again, this court found in Roberts that a probation officer who is an agent of the judicial branch is required to give Miranda warnings when they question a probationer who's in custody. Not a probationer who comes in as a part of a routine visit, okay? But when they are brought into custody. And in Roberts, Roberts was arrested after a search warrant was executed at his girlfriend's house. The probation officer was phoned up. He met the police probationer Mr. Roberts at the jailhouse and then interrogated him. And important though in that case is your rationale, the Ohio Supreme Court's rationale talked about the probation officer, that it's a unique relationship where the client trusts the probation officer often, not always, but oftentimes trusts the probation officer. And because of that trust, that there's a ripeness for abuse. Not unlike the trusting relationship here that our client would have with his mother who turned him over to the social worker, or that one might intuitively have when talking to a social worker who says this is going to be a private meeting. This court also in Roberts recognized that one of the overarching principles in Miranda is to protect against the appearance of deception. And we have tons and tons of deception in this case, beginning with the social worker's deception with mom, continuing through her lack of candor with the child in this case. But Roberts isn't the only authority, okay? Roberts isn't the only authority that shows that Jackson isn't the end all be all on when a law enforcement or when Miranda needs to be given. In Gallagher, this court found that a parole officer also, when interviewing somebody on parole, needs to give Miranda warnings. And again, they talked about the heavy psychological pressure placed on an adult parolee, the heavy psychological pressure placed on them by this unique relationship. And also, like the probation office, there is often a trusting relationship, and it's assumed oftentimes that the parolee may think that his or her comments to his her parole officer are being confidential. Again, we have that situation here as well, don't we, where the probation officer, the social worker, assures mom that this is a private conversation, a fact that deeply troubles.
Did the mother know what the subject of the conversation was going to be about?
She had her inklings. That's right. That's what she says. She says, I knew what the allegations had been made. I knew what was going on. There's no evidence that she knew that this was a criminal investigation of any sort. There's no indication that she assumed that the social worker was conducting a criminal investigation of any sort. This was a consensual sexual relationship between a 12-year-old and a 13-year-old. I don't think there's any suggestion that mom believed this was criminal, but she said that she had a hunch, that she kind of knew what it was about. She is steadfast in her insistence that she was never told by the social worker what it was about. And now the social worker has a different story. But moving on again to show that Jackson isn't the end all be all, we also have Estelle, which was addressed in Jackson, but it's the psychiatric examiner, the court ordered psychiatric examiner. And I think what's critical there is the Supreme Court relied on the use of the statement, how that statement was going to be used to determine that it should have been Mirandized. And Mathis is a tax investigator case where the tax investigator was found to be operating such that he or she had to give Miranda warnings. And interesting there is the Supreme Court rejects two arguments that are very similar to the arguments made by the government in this case. There they reject this idea that in the IRS case in Mathis, the government had argued that, well, you know, we weren't sure these charges were actually be taken criminal, could have been just subject to a civil proceeding. And because the statements could have only been subject to a civil proceeding, that they didn't need to be Mirandized. And the Supreme Court rejected that argument. Also, talked about that because Mathis was in jail for an entirely separate offense than he was being questioned about, that it wasn't, I guess, custodial. And again, that was rejected as well. There, the court said that these differences are too minor and too shadowy, justified departure from the well-considered conclusions of Miranda. I think that Jackson isn't the final word on all of the tests. It's not the exclusive test for when Miranda is given. But even following the test that is announced in Jackson, this case is different in many regards. One, we've talked about in a sense that this is a case where the social worker did the entire investigation. Unlike Jackson, in Jackson, the detective actually went to go interview Mr. Jackson in jail. And then I think it was 5 days later that the social worker went. That's evidence that these are two parallel investigations going on, that this wasn't in one singular investigation, like our case, which is one singular investigation. We also have evidence of the exchange of voicemails in our case between Detective Cottam and the social worker. But I also think equally important is the fact that the memorandum of understanding between law enforcement in Cuyahoga County and Children and Family Services mandates that if the law enforcement wants to be the solely in charge of interviewing any alleged perpetrators, that they need to let the Children and Family Services know that within 10 days. Underlying that is the assumption that the Children and Family Services investigation is kind of running the point, especially as it relates to interviewing perpetrators, that they will either Children and Family Services will run the point or will be done in conjunction with
So are you saying that that's the reason that the interview took place by the social worker, to be the shill for the police?
I don't know. I think
every time a social worker interviews someone in a situation where there is a potential criminal activity, even though they're mandated to turn that report over to the police, they're an agent of the police, because we haven't found that.
No, you haven't. And I don't think that Jackson makes clear. Jackson makes unequivocally clear that the statute that requires cooperative investigations and requires mandatory reporting, Jackson makes clear that that does not automatically remove this under the purview, put this under the purview of the Fifth Amendment. And with that, we agree. But when I say, and I don't mean to go along with the word shill, I guess, because here the institutional relationship between Children and Family Services and law enforcement and Cottam and the social worker and Bradley in this case is such that the direction and control that seems to be imagined by Jackson is not going to be found. You're not going to have that overt direction because of the institutional relationship that's there, the pre-existing relationships. And Jackson makes it even, encourages, and in my mind, encourages the gamesmanship in situations where what the government couldn't do through their investigator, getting unwarranted statements, they now can't do through a social worker. Now, the social worker had dual purposes, and often cases they do. In this case, their second justification, creating a safety plan, is dubious at best, because they don't interview the child, our child, MH, for over 2 months. And actually longer when you consider the date of the offense. The alleged offense happened in August, and he's not interviewed, I believe, until December. So there is no ongoing. And what furtherance does a 13-year-old child in MH's situation have to do with the safety plan? Those are questions that are better served for the adults in that child's life and the child. So I do think here the overarching reason for the social worker's investigation, it was in fact the criminal investigation. And I'll reserve the remaining time I have for rebuttal.
You don't have any, but go ahead.
I know, I see that. Thank you.
Okay. All right, Ms. Mayor.
Thank you, Chief Justice O'Connor. May it please the court, my name is Jennifer Meyer. I represent the appellee, the state of Ohio, in this matter. I'd like to defer the balance of my argument time to Deputy Solicitor General Samuel Peterson. We ask that you affirm the 8th District's decision to overturn the motion to suppress MH's admissions to the social worker. There are four reasons why. One, there is no agency relationship between the social worker and the police, especially revised code section 2151.421, former subsection F1 does not create such an agency relationship that my colleague, Mr. Kuzman's claims exists. Secondly, there's no evidence that the officers had direct control or advised the social worker in her investigation. There's actually evidence to the contrary in the record.
Ms. Meyer, even though they didn't necessarily have to advise or direct, there was an understanding that Bradley would supply the police officers with whatever she got from her investigation, and the police officers did say, be sure we get that information or that we know. There is an understanding of exchange of information, correct?
Well, it's not an understanding. It's a statutory duty pursuant to revised code 2151.
Well, that's what I mean. So why does it matter that that Bradley wasn't controlled by law enforcement?
Because this court has already determined that the statutory requirements under 2151.421 is not sufficient in itself to create an agency relationship. There must be other factors that create the agency relationship between law enforcement officers and the social worker. If the law enforcement officer had called the social worker and said, I want you to talk to him about this, this, and this, then that would be at the direction and control. But that was not the case in this incident, because the police weren't even aware that the social worker had already interviewed the victim and that she interviewed MH at the time. So there's no evidence in the record that law enforcement influenced or directed or controlled the social worker. Further, there also wasn't a custodial investigation, as my colleague had mentioned, that he had said that this was a custodial interrogation by the social worker. That is not true. There's no police presence at the time. He was not coerced by the social worker. He was not under arrest. Even after his admission, he was still not under arrest and he was free to leave. He was driven to the center by his mother, not by law enforcement officers.
Was he explicitly told, MH, we're here to talk, you can leave at any time?
According to the record, I do not see that he was told that. I am not aware if the mother was told that, but it looks like the social worker testified that she did not tell MH why he was there or he was free to leave, and instead in the interview decided to be more of a friendly back and forth at first and conversation with MH, which is another evidence that it wasn't coerced, that it was a friendly conversation. Fourth, the statement by MH was voluntary. It was not coerced in any sort of way. And we look at that by the totality of the circumstances. My colleague in his brief suggested that...
Counselor, how do you discern whether a child makes a voluntary statement?
Yes, Your Honor. So you still have to look at the totality of the circumstances, and the fact that the individual is a minor is one of the factors, but it is not one of the determining factors. Okay. So yes, MH was, we believe he was 13 at the time, even though there's some evidence in the record, I'm say 13, 14, that he was 13 years of age. Okay. But also his mentality, prior criminal experience, which isn't in the record, we don't have that. The length of the interview, which was only 40 minutes, 30 to 40 minutes has already been determined to be not lengthy in time. The intensity of the interview, we know from the record that the social worker was not coercive or intensive. It was a back and forth discussion. And even regarding the admission.
But I guess when we look at voluntariness, mm-hmm. There has to be an understanding that you have an option not to say anything. Is there any evidence that he was told, you don't have to talk to me, you don't have to answer any of my questions, you don't have to be here with me alone, you can have your mother with you?
No, there's none of that in the record that I see. I also don't feel that he has to be told that he has to directly be told that you can leave.
At 13 years old?
Yes.
Okay.
Is that because he's experienced and should know, or why?
I think because his mother, he already had conversations with his mother, and the letter that was sent to the mother said that this was voluntary. When the social worker spoke to MH's mother, also made clear that this was voluntary, but she wanted to talk to him. And she said that she would bring him down the very next day.
And so are you saying his mother told him it's voluntary and you can leave at any time?
I can't say that. I cannot speculate.
So you don't
it's
know
not in the record.
You have no, there is no record. There is nothing to support the fact that this child knew that, number one, he didn't have to make a statement without an attorney. He didn't even have to sit there and be interviewed.
That's correct. Fair? It's not. It is not in the record. That is correct, Your Honor.
Okay.
Also, though, I do want to get back to the fact that the social worker did not make any threat of violence, coercion, or that he was going to be arrested. And the social worker asked him, are you sexually active? She did not say, did you do this to the victim? She asked if he was sexually active, and he said yes, and she asked with whom, and then he said the victim. And so that was more voluntary statement. It wasn't coerced by the social worker. I do want to also touch about something that my colleague had mentioned about Roberts and Gallagher. Those cases are distinguishable in this matter because all of those cases come from parole officers, and all of those individuals were already under arrest at the time. And that was not the case here. He was not under arrest, and he wasn't even arrested after his admission. Also, I wanted to touch on the fact that according to the record, that MH's mother did know about the allegations. On page 18 of the transcript, initially she said she had no idea, she didn't know anything about the allegations, and then she backtracked a little bit and said, well, I did know, the victim's mother told me about it. There's also evidence in the record to suggest that because this has family ties, that some other family members had gotten involved. And so the mother was aware of the allegations. And there was quite a lengthy conversation, according to the social worker, there was quite a lengthy conversation between MH's mother and the social worker prior to her bringing him down to the
council. Did the social worker tell the mother that this sexual activity was illegal?
I do not know, Your Honor. It's not in the record. And I can't speculate. It's not in the record, but I can't speculate if it was done or not done. So if there are no further questions, Your Honors, I would like to defer the remainder of my time to Mr. Peterson. Thank you.
Peterson.
Thank you, Your Honor. Chief Justice O'Connor, and may it please the court. I'd like to make two points here this morning, one about Jackson and the other about the due process clause and voluntariness. And I think the second one will answer some of the questions that the court has had already this morning. But first, Jackson. My friend on the other side has suggested that Jackson is incomplete. Respectfully, that's just not true. If the court looks to the syllabus of Jackson, it is unequivocal. It says that the statutory duty to cooperate and share information with law enforcement does not make a social worker an agent of law enforcement. There must be other evidence that demonstrates the social worker acted at the direction and control. If the court wishes to adopt MH's reading of Miranda, it would necessarily have to overrule Jackson. But it shouldn't do that because for many of the cases, for example, Roberts, Estelle, Mathis, that you've heard about today, Jackson already dealt with them. It already distinguished them. It already explained why those did not support the result being argued for. And the same thing, Justice Stewart, you had asked about the obligation to share information between social worker and the law enforcement. Again, Jackson addressed that. And Jackson was a sex abuse case. And so those statutory obligations, memorandum of understanding, those were all already addressed in Jackson. And so if the court were to adopt MH's argument here, it would necessarily conflict with Jackson. But going to the second—
Is that necessarily correct? Or couldn't we look at just the facts in this particular case and come to the same conclusion that the dissenting judge did, that in this case, the sole purpose was to determine whether or not some inappropriate sexual behavior happened between the two of them, and if anything criminal happened, and then to pass that on to law enforcement. There was a situation where the two were in the house, and the immediate priority for the social worker was a overall safety issue. They were just wanting to find out what happened and criminal, and then pass it over. Do we have to necessarily overturn Jackson?
I think you do, Your Honor, because Jackson said you have to look to see whether there was the direction or control of law enforcement. And here there's no evidence of that. There's no coordination. Any communication even occurred after MH was interviewed. But you know, Your Honor, you quoted a portion of social worker Bradley's testimony. And I think that language has been misrepresented in some of the briefing, because it's not saying that she is seeking to do a criminal investigation. She's simply articulating what her job is, find out what happened, and then what her statutory duty is, convey anything criminal to law enforcement. And so that's not saying that she has a law enforcement purpose. And so I think you would have to overrule Jackson. But I'd like to move on to the due process clause and the voluntariness questions, because Miranda already addresses the inherent coercion in a custodial interrogation. Miranda takes off the table any coercion that would necessarily result from a voluntary interrogation. And so what you have to have for an involuntary statement is something above and beyond Miranda. This court in 1988, State v. Clark, said that they were looking at things like physical abuse, threats, deprivation of food, medical treatment, or sleep. And the court, more recently in State v. Barker, talked about the totality of the circumstances test. And this is the same totality of the circumstances test that the court adopted in In re Watson in 1989. And so it already accounts for age, but it also looks to physical deprivation or mistreatment and the existence of threat or inducement. And now I know in the briefing, MH has argued that JDB somehow changes the totality of the circumstances test, but that's simply not an accurate reading of JDB. I would encourage the court to go back and look at JDB and read the entire decision, both the majority and the dissent. And what you would see is that there is widespread agreement that age is a relevant consideration under the due process clause and under the totality of the circumstances test. The only question was whether age also could be a factor for Miranda and the custodial analysis. And the majority said, yes, age did matter for Miranda. The dissent said, no, it shouldn't. But both of them agreed that the due process clause already accounts for age. And the court said the same thing in Barker. And so really what you have—
How do you think the age of this defendant weighs in here in the totality of the circumstances?
Well, Your Honor, I think it's certainly something that must be considered, but it's also something the 8th District did consider. If you, in a Miranda analysis, for example, which they looked at paragraph 25 and 26 and 32 and 33, they gave great weight to his age. But they said that there was no allegation, let alone no evidence, there's not even any allegation of threats or the type of intimidation that would come along with an involuntary statement. And so you can't have a statement being involuntary simply because it's custodial. That would render every interview with a juvenile, even when Miranda was applied, even when it was properly followed, inadmissible. And so that can't be the test, but the only evidence that MH has pointed to is the same evidence that he says renders this a custodial interrogation. So we should ask that the court affirm the statement is neither barred by the Fifth Amendment Miranda, nor by the 14th Amendment and the due process.
So, counsel, if the social worker never says, there's nothing in the record, says to either the child or the mother, you are free to go at any time. This is not, you're not mandated to come in here and talk with me. If that is never mentioned to them, does that factor into the totality of the circumstances?
I think, Your Honor, it's a totality test, and so it does factor in, but it is not a strong factor, because what you're talking about, that is essentially an advisement of your Miranda rights in many respects. And so if simply failing to give that type of warning was enough to render a statement involuntary, then there would never be any situation in which case you would barring these statements in just a basic.
Well, don't you think a social worker should tell that to anybody they're discussing potential criminal activity with?
Your Honor, that may be best practices, and two, that may be a good public policy. Justice Lanzinger, in her concurring opinion in In Re MW, talking about statutory rights to counsel, talked about the public policy considerations for when juveniles should have a statutory right as opposed to a constitutional right to counsel. And she emphasized there that it's a policy question that should be left to the General Assembly. So too here, what a social worker must say, or when juvenile statements must be barred when they're made to a social worker, those are public policy questions, but I urge the court not to constitutionalize those and leave them to the General Assembly. If it finds that MH's arguments and those of Zemecki are persuasive, then it's up to them to adopt that policy. We'd ask the court to affirm the 8th District. Thank you.
Thank you. Counsel, you've got 30 seconds. Turn on your microphone, though, to make use of them.
Couple things. This was not a friendly conversation between the social worker and the child. I'd want to ask yourself, when a child is talking about these very sensitive topics like his virginity and a single sexual encounter, would he be disclosing that to a total stranger in an authority position? And DJB, while is in fact in agreement that due process applies, DJB informs how due process should be applied. And in that case, they said it's beyond dispute that a juvenile is unlikely to feel free to leave and terminate an interrogation. That informs the voluntariness of any interactions between an interrogator and a juvenile. And it's beyond dispute that the psychological pressure here, the state keeps referring to the lack of coercion, but the psychological vulnerability of children does away with the need for a rubber hose. You don't need a rubber hose. You don't need coercion when you are interrogating a child, because of all of the psychological reasons that are laid out in the briefing and in DJB. They are prone to comply with authority figures. They are prone to listening. They're apt to give up their rights because they don't know their rights, even when they're informed of them. So you don't need a rubber hose, as suggested by the government, in order to have a due process violation in interrogating children.
Thank you, Your Honor. We will take the matter under advisement and you'll be notified of our decision. Marshall, will you adjourn court, please?
Hear ye, hear ye, hear ye. This open session of the Honorable Supreme Court of Ohio now stands adjourned.